"It's a judgment on me," moaned Cohen. He tugged ineffectually at his bonds. Twoflower peered at him muzzily. Gansier's slingshot had raised quite a lump on the back of his head, and he was a little uncertain about things, starting with his name and working upwards.
"I should have been listening out," said Cohen. "I should have been paying attention and not being swayed by all this talk about your washer names, your din-chewers. I must be getting soft."
He levered himself up by his elbows. Herenna and the rest of the gang were standing around the fire in the cave mouth. The luggage was still and silent under its net in a corner.
"There's something funny about this cave," said Bethan.
"What?"
said Cohen.
"Well, look at it. Have you ever seen rocks like those before?"
Cohen had to agree that the semicircle of stones around the cave entrance were unusual. Each one was higher than a man, and heavily worn, and surprisingly shiny. There was a matching semicircle on the ceiling. The whole effect was that of a stone computer, built by a druid, with a vague idea of geometry and no sense of gravity.
"Look at the walls, too."
Cohen squinted at the wall next to him. There were veins of red crystal in it. He couldn't be quite certain, but it was almost as if little points of light kept flashing on and off deep within the rock itself. It was also extremely draughty. A steady breeze blew out of the black depths of the cave.
"I'm sure it was blowing the other way when we came in," whispered Bethan. "What do you think, Twoflower?"
"Well, I'm not a cave expert," he said, "but I was just thinking that's a very interesting stalag thingy hanging from the ceiling up there. Sort of bulbous, isn't it?"
They looked at it.
"I can't quite put my finger on why," said Twoflower, "but I think it might be rather a good idea to get out of here."
"Oh, yes," said Cohen sarcastically. "I suppose we just better ask these people to untie us and let us go, eh?"
Cohen hadn't spent much time in Twoflower's company, otherwise he would not have been surprised when the little man nodded brightly and said, in the loud, slow, and careful voice he employed as an alternative to actually speaking other people's languages,
"Excuse me, could you please untie us and let us go? It's rather damp and draughty in here. Sorry."
Bethan looked sidelong at Cohen.
Was he supposed to say that?
"It's novel, I grant you."
And indeed, three people detached themselves from the group around the fire and came towards them. They didn't look as if they intended to untie anyone. The two men, in fact, looked the sort of people who, when they see other people tied up, start playing around with knives and making greasy suggestions and leering a lot. Herenna introduced herself by drawing her sword and pointing it at Twoflower's heart.
"Which one of you is Rincewind the Wizard?" she said. "There were four horses. Is he here?"
"I don't know where he is," said Twoflower. "He was looking for some onions."
"Then you are his friends, and he will come looking for you," said Herenna. She glanced at Cohen and Bethan, then looked closely at the luggage. Trumon had been emphatic that they shouldn't touch the luggage. Curiosity may have killed a cat, but Herenna's curiosity could have massacred a pride of lions. She slit the netting and grasped the lid of the box. Twoflower winced.
"Locked," she said eventually. "Where is the key, fat one?"
It hasn't got a key," said Twoflower.
"There is a keyhole," she pointed out.
"Well, yes, but if it wants to stay locked, it stays locked," said Twoflower uncomfortably.
Herenna was aware of Gansier's grin. She snarled.
"I want it open," she said.
"Gansier, see to it."
She strode back to the fire. Gansier drew a long thin knife and leaned down close to Twoflower's face.
"She wants it open," he said.
He looked up at the other man and grinned.
"She wants it open, Weems."
"Yeah."
Gansier waved the knife slowly in front of Twoflower's face.
"Look," said Twoflower patiently, "I don't think you understand. No one can open the luggage if it's feeling in a locked mood."
"Oh, yes, I forgot," said Gansier thoughtfully. "Of course, it's a magic box, isn't that right? With little legs, they say. I say, Weems, any legs your side? No?"
He held his knife to Twoflower's throat.
"I'm really upset about that," he said. "So's Weems. He doesn't say much, but what he does is, he tears bits off people. So,
open the box. He turned and planted a kick on the side of the box, leaving a nasty gash in the wood. There was a tiny little click. Gansier grinned. The lid swung up slowly, ponderously. The distant firelight gleamed off gold, lots of gold, in plate, chain and coin, heavy and glistening in the flickering shadows.
"All right," said Gansier softly.
He looked back at the unheeding men around the fire, who seemed to be shouting at someone outside the cave. Then he looked speculatively at Weems. His lips moved soundlessly with the unaccustomed effort of mental arithmetic. He looked down at his knife. Then the floor moved.
"I heard someone," said one of the men, "down there, among the rocks."
Rincewind's voice floated up out of the darkness.
"I say," he said.
"Well?" said Herenna.
"You're in great danger," shouted Rincewind. "You must put the fire out."
"No, no," said Herenna. "You've got it wrong. You are in great danger, and the fire stays."
"There's this big old troll."
"Everyone knows trolls keep away from fire," said Herenna. She nodded. A couple of men drew their swords and slipped out into the darkness.
"Absolutely true," shouted Rincewind desperately. "Only this specific troll can't, you see."
"Can't?" Herenna hesitated. Something of the terror in Rincewind's voice hit her.
"Yes, because you see, you've lit it on his tongue."
Then the floor moved. Old Grandad awoke very slowly from his centuries-old slumber. He nearly didn't awake at all. In fact, a few decades later, none of this could have happened. When a troll gets old and starts to think seriously about the universe, it normally finds a quiet spot and gets down to some hard philosophizing, and after a while starts to forget about its extremities. It begins to crystallize around the edges until nothing remains except a tiny flicker of life inside quite a large hill with some unusual rock strata. Old Grandad hadn't got quite that far. He awoke from considering quite a promising line of inquiry about the meaning of truth and found a hot, ashy taste in what, after a certain amount of thought, he remembered as being his mouth. He began to get angry. Commands skittered along neural pathways of impure silicon. Deep within his silicaceous body, stone slipped smoothly along special fracture lines. Trees toppled, turf split, as fingers the size of ships unfolded and gripped the ground. Two enormous rock slides high on his cliff face marked the opening of eyes like great crusted opals. Rincewind couldn't see all this, of course, since his own eyes were daylight issue only, but he did see the whole dark landscape shake itself slowly and then begin to rise impossibly against the stars. The sun rose. However, the sunlight didn't. What did happen was that the famous Discworld sunlight, which, as has already been indicated, travels very slowly through the disk's powerful magical field, sloshed gently over the lands around the rim and began its soft, silent battle against the retreating armies of the night. It poured like molten gold. Not precisely, of course. Trees didn't burst into flame, people didn't suddenly become very rich and extremely dead, and the seas didn't flash into steam. A better simile, in fact, would be not like molten gold across the sleeping landscape, bright, clean, and above all, slow. Herenna didn't hesitate. With great presence of mind, she ran to the edge of Old Grandad's bottom lip and jumped, rolling as she hit the earth. The men followed her, cursing as they landed among the debris. Like a fat man trying to do press-ups, the old troll pushed himself upwards. This wasn't apparent from where the prisoners were lying. All they knew was that the floor kept rolling under them and that there was a lot of noise going on, most of it unpleasant. Weems grabbed Gensier's arm.
"It's a earthquake," he said. "Let's get out of here."
"Not without the gold," said Gensier.
"What? The gold? The gold? Man, we could be as rich as creosote."
Weems might have had a room temperature IQ, but he knew idiocy when he saw it. Gansier's eyes gleamed more than gold, and he appeared to be staring at Weems's left ear.
Weems looked desperately at the luggage. It was still open, invitingly, which was odd. You'd have thought all the shaking would have slammed the lid shut.
"We'd never carry it," he suggested. "It's too heavy," he added.
"Well, damn, we'll carry some of it," shouted Gansia, and leapt towards the chest as the floor shook again. The lid snapped shut. Gansia vanished. And just in case Weems thought it was accidental, the luggage's lid snapped open again, just for a second, and a large tongue as red as mahogany licked across the broad teeth as white as sycamore. Then it slammed shut again. To Weems's further horror, hundreds of little legs extruded from the underside of the box. It rose very deliberately, and carefully arranging its feet, shuffled around to face him. There was a particularly malevolent look about its keyhole. The sort of look that says, "Go on, make my day." He backed away and looked imploringly at Two Flower.
"I think it might be a good idea if you untied us," suggested Two Flower. "It's really quite friendly once it gets to know you."
Licking his lips nervously, Weems drew his knife. The luggage gave a warning creak. He slashed through their bonds and stood back quickly.
"Thank you," said Two Flower.
"I think my back's gone again," complained Cohen as Bethan helped him to his feet.
"What do we do with this man?" said Bethan.
"We take his knife and tell him to bugger off," said Cohen. "Right?"
"Yes, sir. Thank you, sir," said Weems, and bolted towards the cave mouth.
For a moment he was outlined against the grey pre-dawn sky, and then he vanished. There was a distant cry of, "Ah!" The sunlight roared silently across the land like surf. Here and there, where the magic field was slightly weaker, tongues of morning raced ahead of the day, leaving isolated islands of night that contracted and vanished as the bright ocean flowed onwards. The uplands around the vortex plains stood out ahead of the advancing tide like a great grey ship. It is possible to stab a troll, but the technique takes practice, and no one ever gets a chance to practice more than once. Herena's men saw the trolls loom out of the darkness like very solid ghosts. Blades shattered as they hit silica skins. There were one or two brief, flat screams, and then nothing more but shouts far away in the forest, as they put as much distance as they could between themselves and the avenging earth. Rincewind crept out from behind a tree and looked around. He was alone, but the bushes behind him rustled as the trolls lumbered up after the gang. He looked up. High above him, two great crystalline eyes focused in hatred of everything soft and squelchy, and above all warm. Rincewind cowered in horror as a hand the size of a house rose, curled into a fist, and dropped towards him. Day came with a silent explosion of light. For a moment the huge terrifying bulk of old Grandad was a breakwater of shadow as the daylight streamed past. There was a brief, grinding noise. There was silence. Several minutes passed. Nothing happened. A few birds started singing. A bumblebee buzzed over the boulder that was old Grandad's fist and alighted on a patch of thyme that had grown under a stone fingernail. There was a scuffling down below. Rincewind slid awkwardly out of the narrow gap between the fist and the ground like a snake leaving a burrow. He lay on his back, staring up at the sky past the frozen shape of the troll. It hadn't changed in any way, apart from the stillness, but already the eye started to play tricks. Last night, Rincewind had looked at cracks in stone and seen them become mouths and eyes. Now he looked at the great cliff face and saw the features become, like magic, mere blemishes in the rock. "Wow," he said. That didn't seem to help. He stood up, dusted himself off, and looked around. Apart from the bumblebee, he was completely alone. After poking around for a bit, he found a rock that from certain angles looked like beryl. He was lost and lonely and a long way from home. There was a crunch high above him, and shards of rock spattered into the earth. High up on the face of old Grandad, a hole appeared. There was a brief sight of the luggage's backside as it struggled to regain its footing, and then Two Flower's head poked out of the mouth cave.
"Anyone down there? I say!"
"Hey!" shouted the wizard. "Am I glad to see you?"
"I don't know. Are you?" said Two Flower.
"Am I what?"
gosh, there's a wonderful view from up here.
It took them half an hour to get down. Fortunately, old Grandad had been quite craggy with plenty of handholds, but his nose would have presented a tricky obstacle if it hadn't been for the luxuriant oak tree that flourished in one nostril. The luggage didn't bother to climb, it just jumped and bounced its way down with no apparent harm. Cohen sat in the shade, trying to catch his breath and waiting for his sanity to catch up with him. He eyed the luggage thoughtfully. "The horses have all gone," said Twoflower.
"We'll find them," said Cohen.
His eyes bored into the luggage, which began to look embarrassed. "They were carrying all our food," said Rincewind.
"Plenty of food in the forest."
"I have some nourishing biscuits in the luggage," said Twoflower. "Travellers' digestives. Always a comfort in a tight spot." "I've tried them," said Rincewind. "They've got a mean edge on them," and Cohen stood up, wincing.
"Excuse me," he said flatly. "There's something I've got to know."
He walked over to the luggage and gripped its lid. The box backed away hurriedly, but Cohen stuck out a skinny foot and tripped up half its legs. As it twisted to snap at him, he gritted his teeth and heaved, jerking the luggage onto its curved lid, where it rocked angrily like a maddened tortoise.
"Hey, that's my luggage," said Twoflower. "Why is he attacking my luggage?"
"I think I know," said Bethan quietly. "I think it's because he's scared of it."
Twoflower turned to Rincewind open-mouthed. Rincewind shrugged. "Search me," he said. "I run away from things I'm scared of myself." With a snap of its lid, the luggage jerked into the air and came down running, catching Cohen a crack on the shins with one of its brass corners. As it wheeled around, he got a grip on it just long enough to send it galloping full tilt into a rock.
"Not bad," said Rincewind, admiringly.
The luggage staggered back, paused for a moment, then came at Cohen, waving its lid menacingly. He jumped and landed on it, with both his hands and feet caught in the gap between the box and the lid. This severely puzzled the luggage. It was even more astonished when Cohen took a deep breath and heaved, muscles standing out on his skinny arms like a sock full of coconuts. They stood locked there for some time, tendon versus hinge. Occasionally one or other would creak. Bethan elbowed Twoflower in the ribs.
"Do something," she said.
Said Twoflower. "Yes. That's about enough, I think. Put him down, please." The luggage gave a creak of betrayal at the sound of its master's voice. Its lid flew up with such force that Cohen tumbled backwards, but he scrambled to his feet and flung himself towards the box. Its contents lay open to the skies. Cohen reached inside. The luggage creaked a bit, but it obviously weighed up the chances of being sent to the top of the great wardrobe in the sky. When Rincewind dared to peek through his fingers, Cohen was peering into the luggage and cursing under his breath.
"Laundry?"
he shouted.
"Is that it? Just laundry?"
He was shaking with rage.
"I think there's some biscuits, too," said Twoflower, in a small voice.
"But there was gold, and I saw it eat somebody."
Cohen looked imploringly at Rincewind. The wizard sighed. "Don't ask me," he said. "I don't own the bloody thing."
"I bought it in a shop," said Twoflower defensively. "I said I wanted a travelling trunk."
"Well, that's what you got, all right," said Rincewind.
"It's very loyal," said Twoflower.
Yes, agreed Rincewind, "if loyalty is what you look for in a suitcase."
"Hold on,"
said Cohen, who had sagged onto a rock.
"Was it one of those shops? I mean, I bet you hadn't noticed it before, and when you go back again it wasn't there."
Twoflower brightened.
"That's right.
Shopkeeper, a little wizened old guy, shop full of strange stuff."
"Exactly. Never could find it again. I thought I must have got the wrong street. Nothing but a brick wall where I thought it was. I remember thinking all the time it was rather..."
Cohen shrugged.
"One of those shops," he said.
No one knows why, but all the most truly mysterious and magical items are bought from shops that appear, and after a trading life even briefer than a double glazing company, vanish like smoke. There had been various attempts to explain this, all of which don't fully account for the observed facts. These shops turn up anywhere in the universe, and their immediate non-existence in any particular city can normally be deduced from crowds of people wandering the streets clutching defunct magical items, ornate guarantee cards, and looking very suspiciously at brick walls.
"That explains it, then."
He felt his back and grimaced.
"Bloody horse ran off with me liniment."
Rincewind remembered something and fumbled in the depths of his torn and now very grubby robe. He held up a green bottle.
"That's the stuff," said Cohen. "You're a marvel."
He looked sideways at Two Flower.
"I would have beaten it," he said quietly. "Even if you hadn't called it off, I would have beaten it in the end."
"That's right," said Bethan.
"You two can make yourself useful," he added. "That luggage broke through a troll tooth to get us out. That was Diamond. See if you can find the bitch. I've had an idea about them."
As Bethan rolled up her sleeves and uncorked the bottle, Rincewind took Two Flower to one side. When they were safely hidden behind a shrub, he said, "He's gone barmy."
"That's Cohen the Barbarian you're talking about," said Two Flower, genuinely shocked. "He is the greatest warrior that
was," said Rincewind urgently. "All that stuff with the warrior priests and man-eating zombies was years ago. All he's got now is memories and so many scars you could play noughts and crosses on him."
"He is rather more elderly than I imagined, yes," said Two Flower. He picked up a fragment of diamond.
"So we ought to leave them and find our horses and move on," said Rincewind.
"That's a bit of a mean trick, isn't it?"
"They'll be all right," said Rincewind heartily. "The point is, would you feel happy in the company of someone who would attack the luggage with his bare hands?"
"That is a point," said Two Flower.
"They'll probably be better off without us anyway."
"Are you sure?"
"Positive," said Rincewind. They found the horses wandering aimlessly in the scrub, breakfasted on badly dried horse jerky, and set off in what Rincewind believed was the right direction. A few minutes later, the luggage emerged from the bushes and followed them. The sun rose higher in the sky, but still failed to blot out the light of the star.
"It's got bigger overnight," said Two Flower. "Why isn't anybody doing something?"
"Such as what?"
Two Flower thought. "Couldn't somebody tell Great Artuin to avoid it?" he said. "Sort of go around it."
"That sort of thing has been tried before," said Rincewind. "Wizards tried to tune into Great Artuin's mind."
"It didn't work?"
"Oh, it worked all right," said Rincewind. Only there had been certain unforeseen risks in reading a mind as great as the world turtles, he explained. The wizards had trained up on tortoises and giant sea turtles first to get the hang of the Chelonian frame of mind, but although they knew that Great Artuin's mind would be big, they hadn't realized that it would be slow. "There's a bunch of wizards that have been reading it in shifts for 30 years, said Rincewind. "All they've found out is that Great Artuin is looking forward to something."
"What?"
"Who knows?" They rode in silence for a while through a rough country where huge limestone blocks lined the track. Eventually Two Flower said,
"We ought to go back, you know."
"Look, we'll reach the Smarl tomorrow," said Rincewind. "Nothing will happen to them out here. I don't see why..." He was talking to himself. Two Flower had wheeled his horse and was trotting back, demonstrating all the horsemanship of a sack of potatoes. Rincewind looked down. The luggage regarded him owlishly. "What you looking at?" said the wizard. "He can go back if he wants. Why should I bother?" The luggage said nothing. "Look, he's not my responsibility," said Rincewind. "Let's be absolutely clear about that." The luggage said nothing, but louder this time. "Go on, follow him. You're nothing to do with me." The luggage retracted its little legs and settled down on the track. "Well, I'm going," said Rincewind. "I mean it," he added. He turned the horse's head back towards the new horizon and glanced down. The luggage sat there. "It's no good trying to appeal to my better nature. You can stay here all day for all I care. I'm just going to ride off, okay?" He glared at the luggage. The luggage looked back.
"I thought you'd come back," said Two Flower.
"I don't want to talk about it," said Rincewind.
"Shall we talk about something else?"
"Yeah. Well, discussing how to get these ropes off would be favourite," said Rincewind. He wrenched at the bonds around his wrists. "I can't imagine why you're so important," said Herenna. She sat on a rock opposite them, sword across her knees.
Most of the gang lay among the rocks high above, watching the road. Rincewind and Two Flower had been a pathetically easy ambush.
"Weems told me what your box did to Gensia," she added. "I can't say that's a great loss, but I hope it understands that if it comes within a mile of us, I will personally cut both your throats, yes?"
Rincewind nodded violently.
"Good," said Herenna. "You're wanted dead or alive. I'm not really bothered which, but some of the lads might want to have a little discussion with you about those trolls." if the sun hadn't come up when it did. She left the words hanging and walked away.
Well, here's another fine mess, said Rincewind. He had another pull at the ropes that bound him. There was a rock behind him, and if he could bring his wrists up... Yes, as he thought, it lacerated him while at the same time being too blunt to have any effect on the rope.
But why us? Said Twoflower. It's to do with that star, isn't it?
I don't know anything about the star, said Rincewind. I never even attended astrology lessons at the university.
I expect everything'll turn out all right in the end, said Twoflower.
Rincewind looked at him. Remarks like that always threw him.
"Do you really believe that?" he said. "I mean, really?"
"Well, things generally do work out satisfactorily when you come to think about it."
"If you think the total disruption of my life for the last year is satisfactory, then you might be right. I've lost count of the times I've nearly been killed. I..."
27, said Twoflower.
"What?"
27 times, said Twoflower helpfully. "I worked it out. But you never actually have."
"What? Worked it out?"
said Rincewind, who was beginning to have the familiar feeling that the conversation had been mugged.
No, been killed. Doesn't that seem a bit, well, suspicious?
I've never objected to it, if that's what you mean, said Rincewind.
He glared at his feet. Twoflower was right, of course. The spell was keeping him alive, it was obvious. No doubt if he jumped over a cliff, a passing cloud would cushion his fall. The trouble with that theory, he decided, was that it only worked if he didn't believe it was true. The moment he thought he was invulnerable, he'd be dead. So on the whole, it was wisest not to think about it at all. Anyway, he might be wrong. The only thing he could be certain of was that he was getting a headache. He hoped that the spell was somewhere in the area of the headache and really suffering. When they rode out of the hollow, both Rincewind and Twoflower were sharing a horse with one of their captors. Rincewind perched uncomfortably in front of Weems, who had sprained an ankle and was not in a good mood. Twoflower sat in front of Herenna, which, since he was fairly short, meant that at least he kept his ears warm. She rode with a drawn knife and a sharp eye out for any walking boxes. Herenna hadn't quite worked out what the luggage was, but she was bright enough to know that it wouldn't let Twoflower be killed. After about 10 minutes, they saw it in the middle of the road. Its lid lay open invitingly. It was full of gold.
"Go round it," said Herenna.
"But it's a trap."
"That's right," said Weems, white-faced. "You take it from me."
Reluctantly, they reined their horses around the glittering temptation and trotted on along the track. Weems glanced back fearfully, dreading to see the chest coming after him. What he saw was almost worse. It had gone. Far off to one side of the path, the long grass moved mysteriously and was still. Rincewind wasn't much of a wizard and even less of a fighter. But he was an expert at cowardice, and he knew fear when he smelt it. He said quietly,
"It'll follow you, you know."
"What?" said Weems, distractedly. He was still peering at the grass.
"It's very patient, and it never gives up. That's sapient pearwood you're dealing with. It'll let you think it's forgotten you, then one day you'll be walking along a dark street and you'll hear those little footsteps behind you. Shlup, 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 they'll go. Then you'll start running and they'll speed up. Shlup, 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 shlup.
Shut up!" shouted Weems.
"It's probably already recognised you. So I said shut up!"
Herenna turned round in her saddle and glared at them. Weems scowled and pulled Rincewind's ear until it was right in front of his mouth and said hoarsely,
"I'm afraid of nothing, understand? The wizard stuff, I spit on it."
"They all say that until they hear the footsteps," said Rincewind. He stopped. A knife point was pricking his ribs.